If you've got a Bible, you can open to Proverbs chapter 3. This is the beginning of what we intend to do until the season of Advent, which is a series on wisdom. So we live in a society that celebrates diversity. I assume you've seen the bumper stickers and don't need to be persuaded that that's the case. And celebrating diversity is a good thing, a wise thing. This world is too wide and complex to be seen through any single lens. You can't get a clear picture that way. The Bible's phrase for this actually comes from Ephesians, where Paul refers to the manifold wisdom of God. And that word manifold means many-colored or many-faceted, multi-lensed wisdom of God. That wisdom, the art of living well in the world, requires multiple diverse perspectives. And those perspectives, manifold as they are always of God. Right? To say that we need multiple lenses to see clearly is not to say that all lenses help us see equally well. So sucks. There are many lenses that we need, but they are all rooted in God's creation and shaped by God's character. You could think of a part of creation, the diversity of music. There are many different kinds of music that are beautiful. Yes? Right? And it would be foolish and arrogant to say, no, this is the kind of music that is beautiful. But it would be equally foolish to say, all things done with musical instruments are equally beautiful. Right? The diversity of music encompasses Beethoven and bluegrass, but it only encompasses music that submits to creation, to the laws of physics that govern melody and harmony. Right? That is the manifold wisdom of God. Diverse perspectives of wisdom that are all grounded in who God is. And to get at the manifold wisdom of God, our plan through the fall is to alternate between two books of the Bible that are both books of wisdom that sit right next to each other and seem on the surface to contradict each other over and over again. That's the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes, right, which are two lenses of God's wisdom. Right, and that together help us to see the diversity and beauty of God's design. So that's the idea for the fall. This Sunday, we're going to be in the book of Proverbs. So if wisdom is the art of living well in the world, is sort of knowledge that you can apply to everyday life, the book of Proverbs, it functions like eyeglasses. Right? These glasses, they do not help me to see the entire world, but they do help me to see what's right around me a lot better. Right? And that's what Proverbs gives us, is a clearer view of life that's right around us, that hopefully helps us navigate a little better. Right? Wisdom is important. It is not by itself making a good life. Right? These glasses enable me to be a good driver. They don't make me a good driver. Right? The absence of them makes me a bad driver. Right? To paraphrase a proverb, better to encounter a nearsighted guy on the interstate than a fool in his folly. But just the glasses themselves don't make me skilled. They make skillful living possible. Right? And that's what Proverbs is trying to do for us. To do our best to summarize Proverbs in a 5 or 6 Sundays, we're going to be in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 1 to 12, which go through the kind of primary themes of the wisdom of the book of Proverbs, a couple of verses at a time. All right, so today's passage is chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, which say, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you." In other words, remember Torah, practice shalom. I'm keeping two of the Hebrew words from that passage because they are too rich and manifold for single word English translations. But wisdom tells us, remember Torah, practice shalom. That's where we're going today. So remember Torah. Do not forget my teaching. And the key to understanding the fullness of what's meant by do not forget or remember is in the second half of verse 1. The Proverbs are written as poetry, and a lot of Hebrew poetry says a thing and then re-says a thing in order to clarify. It's called parallelism. And so the second half of the parallel tells us what's really meant by remember. Let your heart keep. In Hebrew, the heart is the core of your personality. It's what motivates you in life. So the kind of remembering that lets your heart keep something is not the kind of remembering that serves you well in history class. We're not talking about remembering the names of the generals at the Battle of Gettysburg. It's not even the kind of remembering that serves you in sort of practical errands. This is not actually remembering to pick up a gallon of 1% milk on the way home. This is heart remembering. Remembering who you really are. That's what the proverb is talking about. Which, of course, in order to remember who we are, we have to know who we are. Which raises the question, how do we know who we are? And the answer is there in verse 1, based on my teaching. And that word teaching, it's not the sort of generic Hebrew word for instruction. It's not mitzvah. It is Torah. So it says, my son, do not forget my Torah. Torah is a word encompassing the first 200 or so pages of the Bible. The books called Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And those books together tell a story, a foundational story of God committing himself to love a people and then commanding that people to live in love. That's Torah. God's commitment to love us and God's commands for us to love. That's what tells us who we are. Notice that the verb wisdom pairs with identity. With who you are is remember. Wisdom does not say, define your identity. Wisdom does not say, defend your identity. Wisdom says, remember your identity. Don't go out there and try to determine who you are. Don't go out there and protect your sense of who you are from people who disagree with you. Remember who you are. Remember who Torah says that you are. Doing this, remembering Torah, will be like putting on a pair of glasses if you're nearsighted. It won't transport you into a fundamentally different world, but it will allow you to see the world that you've always been in much more clearly and to live in it more wisely if we remember who we are according to Torah. Now, I want to say a sort of caveat here that there is, in remembering Torah, space for discovering your individuality, the particular way that God has created you. Torah is a story that tells us who we are, and it's a story with room to breathe. Think of it like learning a language. The fact that we all, I think, speak the same language, we could decide that confines us, makes us obey the same conventions and live within the same framework. But in reality, the fact that we all speak the same language, live within the same conventions, obey the same framework of what words mean, frees us. to communicate with creativity. I can't tell you anything personal unless we commit to being within the English language together. So this remembering who we are through Torah actually frees us for creative wisdom in the same way that all speaking the same language frees us to communicate. That's what's going on here. Right? And now, I said the story of Torah is the story of God committing to love his people and then commanding his people to live in love. The order there is critical. And it's that order that wisdom is concerned we would forget. Because almost everything else in our lives goes the other direction. Torah says, you're loved, now here's how to live. Notice the structure of verse 1. There's two exhortations to remember, right? Do not forget, let your heart keep. And those two exhortations are suspended like cables on a bridge between three pillars. My son, my Torah, my commandments. Torah is the bridge from my son, from being loved, to my commandments. Here's how to live. The story of who you are, according to the Torah, is a story in which place leads to participation, in which my son leads to my commandments. That's the opposite of how we're used to living. We're used to living, if you perform, then you can have a place. Yeah? I mean, think about literal places, right? If you're an adult, the place where you plan to sleep, right? You had to perform first, right? You had to apply for a lease and pay a deposit, or you had to apply for a whole loan and submit and try to be the one who could actually purchase the house, compete with everybody else for overbidding the most. And then you had to keep performing, right? There's rent to pay or a mortgage to pay. And even if you happen to live in a place that you own and is paid off, you better pay taxes and insurance, or else that's not going to be your place for very long. Right? Performance leads to place. That's what we're used to. This is pervasive, is it not? We're going to do participation now. In what other areas of life does performance lead to place? Sports, right? After, you know, Corvallis City League, right? If you want to make the high school team, you better perform first, right? College, grad school, before that, right? We start training students really young. If you perform, then you can have a place on the honor roll in this institution. Where else? Say that louder. Orchestra. The orchestra. Yes, right? Yeah. Pretty much any job you got, if you want to keep your place, you better keep performing, even if you're your own boss. That includes this job. In order to have a place as Calvin's pastor, I had to perform first. Right? I had to interview and submit sermons, fill out paperwork. Right? We absorb this as the way of the world. Perform first, and then maybe you can have a place, as long as you keep performing. And so we naturally read that back onto God. Read that back into the Torah. It's easy to do with the Torah because if you've read it, there's a lot of commands in there. Right? There's a lot of laws. There's a lot of instructions on how to perform and participate. And so we naturally flip the order around and go, oh, with God, it's just like with everyone and everything else. As long as I perform, I can have a place with him. And the beginning of wisdom, this, like, the start of the summary of what the book of Proverbs has to say is it goes the other direction. If you remember Torah, you remember that with God you have a place. And being in that place teaches you how to participate. This is shot through the whole Torah from beginning to end. I'm not going to give anything like all of these examples. I just want to give one from the beginning and one from the end. Right? The story of the Torah in the book of Genesis begins with God giving people a place. Right? God plants a garden, and then he puts Adam and Eve in it. They haven't done a thing. They have not performed in any way. And God says, here you go. They received the place as a gift first. And we might say, okay, sure, that was true before things fell apart, before the center could not hold, but now the entire world is upside down. It doesn't work that way anymore. And you're right if you think that the world is upside down. But the story of the Torah continues with God inviting his people to live right side up in an upside down world. So that at the very end of the Torah, in the book of Deuteronomy, God has chosen a place for his people, the land of Canaan, often called the Promised Land. And it's a land, like Eden, already fruitful, already abundant, already prepared. And God says, I am giving you this place. And in this place, you will live as my people. Remember who you are. A people who have been given a place by God. Now, it's important to note, we are given a place in which to participate. God put Adam and Eve in the garden and gave them instructions. Work the garden, cultivate it, continue to grow it, and keep it, guard it, protect it. In Deuteronomy, God says, here's your place in the land of Canaan, and here are some instructions. Here's how to live well here. We're not being given a place in which to put our feet up and do nothing. But we are being given the place first and then invited to learn how to participate. It is a gift to steward. We are people who have received our place from God and are learning how to steward it. This is my hope for us as a community, that we would grow into this. And how we live this way, right side up in an upside down world, is critical, right? Not forgetting is work. And there are a number of good answers to how. A few of them have been mentioned already this morning, or even practiced. They're often called the spiritual disciplines, right? So a spiritual discipline that Rachel referred us to is Sabbath. Right? I live in this world that says you have to perform in order to keep your place or to get your place. Sabbath says, one day a week, I'm going to refuse to perform. I will accomplish nothing. I will earn nothing. As a practice of remembering that I don't have to earn it. Christian led us in the Akathist prayer, which is a prayer of gratitude for the creation that we are in. Right? We give thanks, we offer gratitude in response to a gift. Thanks is not the appropriate response for something that you've earned. Right? And so prayers of gratitude to God for what's all around us are a discipline to help us live right side up, to remember who we are according to Torah. These are good answers. They're not the answer that's in the text. Right? The answer that's in Proverbs is that we remember who we are by reminding one another. So the beginning of the proverb, my son, do not forget my teaching, on one level, that's God speaking to us, right? Only God can say my of Torah. It belongs to him. Right? So God is saying to all of us, my children, do not forget my teaching. On another level, the entire book of Proverbs is a father speaking to his adolescent son, explaining how to live wisely, right? So this is God to all of us And this is Nick to Anson. This is Tim to Caleb. We remember by reminding one another. That's what we're meant to do. For this to happen in relationships that are close enough for someone to know who you actually are and grounded enough for that person to remind you when you forget without the relationship coming apart. This is my hope, my prayer for us as a community, is that we would be a people where everyone who is willing to be reminded of who they are has someone who is willing to do the reminding for them. We are not there yet. It's a hope. It's a prayer. This is the direction that we're meant to live together. Right? These are the kind of relationships that Jesus lived and died and lives again in order to give us with God our Father in heaven and with one another. To be sure enough of our place that we're free to admit we don't fully know how to participate yet. To be confident enough that we are loved, that it is okay to admit we don't really know how to love each other yet. But we can grow into it. This is what it is to remember Torah. And we do this remembering of Torah, because wisdom says it leads to shalom. Remembering Torah leads to practicing shalom. This is verse 2, for length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. This is trying to convey quantity and quality. The word peace, that's the Hebrew word shalom, and peace is the least bad that we can do in an English word. But shalom means more than the absence of hostility. It means a sort of comprehensive well-being. It means all the little parts of your life. All of them. Home and work, social dynamics, economics, spirituality, psychology, it's all working together as it should be. Right? There is shalom in your body if and only if all of your body parts are working in concert as they are meant to. Right? If you have a broken arm, there is not shalom in your body. Something is amiss. And shalom is nothing amiss. Everything as it should be. And the wisdom is telling us that shalom comes from remembering who we are according to Torah. Now, this is very easy to misunderstand. The Proverbs almost say a couple of very untrue things. And so I want to take a couple of minutes and say, that's not what it's saying. Okay? So this is not a transaction between remembering Torah and experiencing shalom. Okay? There's not an exchange rate between commandments kept and days of peace. Proverbs are principles. They are not promises. Okay? Reading them as promises will get you into a lot of trouble. If you read the Proverbs as promises, then when your life is going better than your neighbor's, you will be led to look down on your neighbor. And if you read the Proverbs as promises, when your life is not going well, you'll be led either into bitterness because God broke his promise to you, or into shame because you must have done something irredeemably wrong in order to not be experiencing shalom. That is not what you're being shown here. A sense of superiority, a sense of shame, a sense of bitterness, these things are not the fruit of the Spirit. There's no transaction, no exchange. Proverbs are principles. They are not. Okay. So that's the first easy misunderstanding. The other thing that you could misunderstand here is this is not a command to sort of rote checklist keeping. Right? Verse 2 does say that length of days and years of life and peace, they will add to you. And the only antecedent that makes any sense for they is the commandments in verse 1. It is really true that keeping God's commandments can lead to shalom. Right? But remember, keeping them in your heart, motivated from the heart to keep them. Right? Not keeping them in your body begrudgingly. So I know it wasn't every single evening of my adolescence, but it kind of felt that way. I was assigned to clean up the kitchen after dinner. Right? Wash the dishes, wipe down the counters, sweep the floors, get it all cleaned up, right? Just suffice it to say, I did not keep the commandment from my heart, right? I pretended to fall asleep at 6:30 p.m. in hopes that my dad would not get me back out of bed to clean the kitchen. That didn't work. I made up little caveats for myself, like I'm not responsible for the Tupperware in which mom and dad took their lunch to work. That's their problem. I'm just doing the dinner dishes, right? Or this counter that wasn't used to make dinner is not my responsibility. Somebody else has to do that, right? No shalom. No shalom in the kitchen, no shalom for me. I realize now as a parent, no shalom for mom and dad either. Right? Even if I was following some of the rules, checking off some of the list. On the other hand, I believe that that repetitive rote experience did lead to, in my early 20s, when Vanessa and I were first married, we didn't have any kids yet, we would regularly eat dinner with our friends Josh and Jesse, who had little ones. And we would all eat dinner together, and then it was time to put Davis and Joe, the little kids, to bed. And Vanessa would help with that, and I would clean the kitchen. Gladly and thoroughly. Like, pull the burners out from the stove and scrub underneath them and put them back and move all the jars on the back of the counter and wipe behind those and clean. Like, I relished it, right? And it was honestly a little awkward and embarrassing how much appreciation Jesse would express for the cleanliness of her kitchen, right? Like, lots of shalom there because it was in the heart. That's what we're being invited into. Not, I did what I was supposed to do, right? But I had the opportunity, having been loved, to live in love. That's what we're talking about here. That really remembering Torah, knowing who we are according to what God has told us, leads to shalom. And this, it is only in remembering who we are that we really get to experience shalom. Right? You know, that attempting to earn your place through performance will not bring shalom. Pretend with me for a second. Let's suspend our disbelief and let's believe one of the common nonsense stories of our day, which is that a job could give you shalom. Right? Let's just say hypothetically that that's true. And let's say you've got that job. Right? It is the job where you are well compensated, where you get along with your colleagues, where you are only required to do projects that you really enjoy doing, right? One caveat. At the end of each work week, 4:30 on Friday, there's a meeting amongst all your bosses to decide whether or not you've done well enough this week to continue next week. You have to keep earning. Is there shalom there? It's your dream job. Is there shalom there? There is no world in which your performance earning your place leads to shalom. On the other hand, having your place with no call to practice or participate, also will not bring shalom. Okay? Let's take up another of the great nonsense stories of our day, which is that if you just took enough of the perfect vacations, you would have shalom. Okay? So imagine your ideal all-inclusive resort. Ski lodge, tropical island, I don't know. Right? And that you have no responsibilities, right? Forget all your needs. All of your desires are met without you having to voice them. You are taken care of in every possible way. Now, I grant you, the first week of that sounds pretty good, right? But what about a year, a decade? Right? How do you not become bored and entitled? Is there any shalom in having a place, but no way to really participate? No way to really contribute? The only shalom that's available for us is if place leads to participation. Is if my son leads to my commandments. The only shalom we will ever experience comes from the story that Torah is telling us. Comes from knowing who God says we are. No matter what kind of house you live in, right, if you have to strive all day in order to keep paying for it, it remains a house. No matter what kind of house you live in, if all you do is sit there and scroll, it's just a house. But if you don't have to constantly strive to earn it, and if it doesn't belong to you alone, then it can start to become a home, a place to live, a place to love, not just a location to exist in. That's what we're being invited into. Place that leads to participation. Real shalom. Scripture is full of images giving us a picture of this shalom. Right? A garden, a picnic between husband and wife in a forest glade, a wedding feast that all participate in for days on end, a city with streets of gold lined with trees of life. The reason it's always images is that they're meant to fire our imagination. The fullness of what shalom really is not something you and I have experienced yet. Right? If the shalom is a feast, we get a little square of bread and a sip from the vine. Right? But it is something we're meant to anticipate, to imagine, to look forward to. This is why Scripture gives us these images. And keeping in mind that God's creation is manifold, that he has filled his earth with diverse and wonderful tastes, and that your imagination is not going to be fired by exactly the same things as mine, I'm going to do some imagining of shalom in the hope that my imagination kindles yours. So when I think of shalom, the place that I imagine, there's a big log cabin with a deep front porch running all the way across the facade. The cabin is set in a meadow sprinkled with wildflowers. There's a little stream winding its way through the meadow. The meadow sits in a valley, and I'm on the porch listening to the songbirds and the breeze rustling the aspen leaves while the sunset occurs behind the mountains to the west. Sunset lasts a really long time in shalom. And the place that I imagine, it's not mine alone. Right? There are others there. Vanessa, my children, friends and extended family. But the point is, everyone there knows me, and I know them, and we are glad to be together. We belong. And this is a place we participate in. Right? It's not some all-inclusive resort. We've worked hard all day and many days before that. We're relaxing now in rocking chairs that some of us built. Our bellies are filled with bread that some of us baked and produce that some of us grew and prepared. We've eaten cheeses that some of us made from the milk of cows and goats that some of us raised. We sip wine that some of us pressed and fermented. We have worked hard. We've participated wisely, but now it's time to rest. Someone, probably not me, plays a mandolin softly. And we laugh together as we watch the children at their own brand of energetic rest, marveling at the fireflies that dance around them, building a dam across the stream to watch what the water does, chasing each other through the field for no reason in particular. And we're all so grateful. We no longer know how not to be grateful. The muscles of our anxiety, of our resentment, of our shame, they've died from disuse. We don't bother telling each other that we belong anymore. Because belonging is the fiber of our being. We savor the beauty around us, point it out to one another, enjoy one another's beauty, because we're undistracted by any compulsion to measure our worthiness to receive such a gift. We're unhaunted by the long-vanished ghosts of comparison and competition. We work and we rest as ones who know we are loved beyond knowing. We've done it today. We'll do it tomorrow. We will live in love. What I'm doing is imagining an answer to a prayer Paul prayed actually just a sentence or so after that phrase, the manifold wisdom of God. And it was a prayer for people who trust in Jesus, and a prayer that you could sum up nicely as, may you remember who Torah says you are, and may you experience shalom. Right. I'm going to close with this prayer. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom all fatherhood in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the length and breadth and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowing, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Brothers and sisters, may you be filled with the fullness of the God who has given you a place and invites you to participate. May your imaginations know that a day is coming when the Lord will breathe on the poor gray embers of your souls and of all creation and turn us to radiance and bring us shalom. Amen.